pancakes. Then Spoonie and Ma would go back and forth trading corny jokes, which I was usually all about, except on Sundays. Sundays was when I butted out and let the two of them have their dry humor because me and Dad, we had pancakes, coffee, hot chocolate for me, and the newspaper. Dad, of course, would be really reading the newspaper. Politics, current events, sports, every single story. But he pulled the comic section out and handed it to me. As I'm sure you can tell by now, my old man doesn't do funny all that well. But me, I love the comics. All of them. But there was one in particular that struck me more than the others. And the funny thing is, I'm not really sure why. It definitely wasn't the funniest one. As a matter of fact, most times it wasn't funny at all. Not to me, at least. It was called The Family Circus. A brilliant name for a comic strip, even though the family in the comic wasn't much like a circus. They were pretty normal. And the strip wasn't really a strip. It was just one image, one scene. Not like the others, which were made up of a whole bunch of different boxes, each one telling more of the story. I know you know what I mean. Everybody knows what comic strips look like. But this one, The Family Circus, was just one picture in a circle. Not even in a box like normal comics. And it was all about this normal white family. Four kids, two parents, and a grandma. And nothing ever seemed to be happening. Like, I remember this one where the oldest son, Billy, and his younger siblings are watching their grandmother talk on the phone, and it just said, "Grandma's phone is really old-fashioned." That's it. See? No punchline. Not funny. And if anything, it's actually pretty lame. But maybe that's why I liked them. Maybe I was fascinated by the fact that it seemed like white families, at least in comics, live simple, easy lives. That, and also the images, I loved them. Loved them. And every Sunday after church, I would tear the family circus out to save. By the time I got to Mrs. Capperdine's class, and by the time she taught the lesson about Aaron Douglas, I had collected like 1,000 family circus clips. I stored them all in a shoebox under my bed and would go through them sometimes just to pick one out to copy sketch. And after a while, I got better at drawing and started making my own family cartoons in the same style. I called them the Real Family Circus, and most of them featured a cartoon version of my father shouting at a cartoon version of my brother. But when I saw Mr. Douglas's work, well, the family circus kind of went out the window. Aaron Douglas was doing a different thing, on a whole other level. Let me describe what his work looks like. Imagine the Lion King, but all the lions are people, black people. So Simba and Mufasa are, let's say, a black king and a prince. Now, imagine that you're looking at them through the thickest fog ever, so thick that you can't make out any actual feature on their bodies, but you can still see their silhouettes. So it could be any king or any prince. But you can still tell they're black. That's Aaron Douglas's work. And the first time Mrs. Capperdine showed us a slide from his series, Aspects of Negro Life, I knew the kind of art I wanted to start making. And so I did. The only difference was that I framed mine in a circle, like the family circus. And that's why I needed Ma to make sure she brought me my sketch pad and pencils. I woke up early, and before doing anything else, before getting up and having a morning pee or brushing my teeth or spirometering, I turned the TV on, muted it, then grabbed my stuff and started sketching on a fresh page. I wasn't sure what I was drawing. That's not true. I knew exactly what I was drawing. The only thing I could. I was going to recreate the scene, what had happened to me, what was playing constantly on the news, on the page. First, the outline. A teenage boy, hands up, no, erase, hands down, no, hands behind his back. Outline of a figure behind him, bigger than he is, holding him around the neck, no, not that. Fist in the air, no, not that either. Hand pushing through the teenage boy's chest, a building behind him, a store, person in the doorway, cheering. After the rough outline, I started shading, which was the tricky part. See, in Aaron Douglas's work, there's always this haziness, this ghostliness to everything. But then there's also lots of light, as if light beams just break through certain parts of the paintings. I like that. But in order for me to get that look with pencils, I have to do a lot of shading. A lot of licking my finger and smearing the pencil lead to make a lighter gray on some parts of the paper, then scratch the pencil over and over again on some other areas to make darker marks. Like I said, tricky. Clarissa came in the middle of me rubbing my wet thumb on the paper, adding a little light to a dark area. "Hey there," she said, bringing in breakfast. "How we doing?" "I'm cool," I said, smirking. Clarissa set the food down, pancakes and fruit cocktail. She glanced at the pad, the black and gray smudges probably seeming like a crazy mess to her. Then she shot her eyes at the silent TV. "So you're an artist, huh?" she said, her focus now back on my work. "Yeah," I said. "I knew it." I looked at her curiously. "Oh, yeah? How you know?" "I don't know. I could just tell." She could just tell? Yeah, right. What she really meant to say was, "I want to say something, but I don't know what to say." Instead, she followed with, "Mind if I look?" "It's just the beginning," I prefaced, handing her the sketch pad. Clarissa, who, by the way, couldn't have been much older than Spoonie, maybe early 20s, white, freckles, bright red hair, looked at the start of my new piece. "What you gonna call it?" "Don't know yet," I said, shrugging. Sheesh, even that hurt. "Well, it looks like it's gonna be good. I mean, not good because, I mean, this whole thing, this, I mean..." She went bright red but soldiered on. "I just mean it looks like it's gonna be nice. Nice art," she finished, handing the pad back to me. "You've seen the news," I said, letting her off the hook. Clarissa glanced at the TV again, then back to me. She sighed. "Yeah, and I think it's bullshit." She put her hand to her mouth, probably realizing that maybe nurses shouldn't curse. Not that that was my rule. It just seemed like it was probably discussed somewhere in the training that you might want to refrain from using foul language around patients. I liked it, though, and even thought about responding with a, "Hell yes, bullshit," but figured that would probably be a little too much.
"I think it's just so..."
Clarissa couldn't finish her statement. I nodded to let her know I understood and that I was having just as much trouble trying to figure it all out, too. But one thing we could agree on was the part about it being bullshit. To cut some of the discomfort that now surrounded us, I flipped through the pages in the sketchbook to show her some of my more finished pieces. "This is what a completed piece looks like," I said, holding the pad up. The image was of silhouettes of soldiers, maybe 20 of them in a line, marching. At the back were babies, marching, and they progressively got bigger, older, and right in the middle was the ultimate image of a strong soldier. And then they started getting smaller again, becoming a baby again.
"Wow," she said. "It's beautiful. Why do you frame them in a circle like this? Why not use the whole page?"
"Because, well, the circle changes how you see it. Like, what are we looking through? A telescope? A peephole? The sight of a gun?"
"I see," she said. "But how come none of them have faces?"
"I don't know. Maybe they're there, but they're not. Like ghosts or invisible people," I said, instantly thinking that sounded dumb, but hoping Clarissa would just think I sounded artsy. She nodded, then glanced at the TV again. It was like a magnet. My face was on the screen.
"Well, listen here, Rashad the artist," Clarissa said low. "Don't forget what I said about getting up and moving around. It's important."
She wagged her finger at me playfully. "I'll come back and check on you later." I worked on the drawing for a while until my hand started to cramp up, which is just one of those things that happen when you work with pencil. Seems like some genius would have figured out how to make pencils out of rubber or something a little softer, even though that's probably a silly thing to even think. But when your hand starts aching in the middle of such a personal piece, there's no telling what you might think about. I put the pencil and pad down and decided to follow Clarissa's instructions and get up. But not only did I decide to get up, I decided to get the hell out of that empty, boring, beige hospital room. Room 409. I climbed out of bed, snatched the back of my robe closed, and ventured out into the wild, not so wild, world of the hospital. I hunched over like an old man protecting, I guess, my ribs. They hurt more when I stood straight. I eased slowly down the hall, each step pricking me inside. As I looked around at the nurses and the doctors and the families standing around the beds of their loved ones in the rooms with open doors, phones ringing, machines beeping, doors opening and closing, soda cans dropping in vending machines, conversations about next steps and tests and surgeries. At the end of the hall was an elevator that happened to open the moment I got to it. A doctor got off, and I got on for no other reason than that it was there, open, waiting for me. I hit the one button, and down to the first floor I went. Once the doors opened again, I found myself in the busiest part of the building, the main floor where people were checking in, doctors and nurses zipping back and forth to the cafeteria, and most importantly, where the gift shop was. It was the only thing remotely interesting, so Destination Gift Shop was in full effect. It didn't take long for me to realize that hospital gift shops have terrible gifts. At least that one did. I mean, really bad gifts. Oh, so sorry you're in the hospital having your legs amputated. Know what'll make you feel better? A snow globe with a unicorn in it. Oh, so sorry to hear about your cancer, but I've got just the picker-upper, a refrigerator magnet of a lighthouse that says Springfield. Ain't no lighthouses in Springfield, but who cares? I poked around looking at all the snacks. They did have good snacks. Weird doodads and whatnots trying not to make any moves that were too sudden. It was more of a step, step, step. Swivel head to the left, then to the right. Repeat. Nice and easy. The woman behind the counter didn't seem to be paying me any attention and instead was flipping through the newspaper. She had to be in her 60s. I could tell, not because she looked old, she didn't, but because she had all those little moles all over her face that only old black ladies get. My grandma had them. "Can I help you?" she asked, catching me off guard. I threw my hands up and backed away from the assortment of plastic flowers. Just looking," I said, wound up. She zeroed in on me, smirked. "Relax, kid. I've been here long enough to know that no one steals from a hospital gift shop. And if someone did, well, hey, I can't blame them. We should be giving this stuff away." I put my hands down, embarrassed. "Sorry." "Never apologize when there's nothing to be sorry for." She put her eyes back on the newspaper, licked her thumb, then flipped the page. I just stood there like an ass until she spoke again. "But seriously, do you need anything?" I almost apologized again, but caught myself. Not sure why I was all sorry, sorry, sorry all of a sudden. "Nope." "So you just came to see me?" she asked sarcastically. And before I could say no, she demanded, "Say yes." I nodded with a big grin on my face and walked towards the counter. "Yes," followed by the truth. "Honestly, I just needed to get out of my room." "Yeah, I hear you." She closed the paper and extended her hand. "Well, I'm Shirley Fitzgerald." "Rashad," I squeezed her fingers lightly. Mrs. Fitzgerald and I talked a while, but I didn't tell her anything about why I was in the hospital. At least, not the truth. I told her I got banged up in a car accident.
"Were you wearing your seatbelt?" she asked predictably.
"Yep, thankfully." I felt bad lying to an old lady, but I had to. This was the most comfortable I had felt in a while. Turns out the best gift in the gift shop was the fact that it didn't have a TV. No news, no fuss. After we got through why I was in the hospital, I asked Mrs. Fitzgerald how long she'd been working there. "I don't even know. Maybe 3 or 4 years. Lost track. Wait, let me think. Frank died," she started running through the timeline in her head.
"Yeah, 4 years.
Mercy, has it been that long?" She put her hand to her neck and fiddled with the gold chain she was wearing. A ring dangled from it.
"My babies are grown.
My grandbabies, too. And my husband has gone on to glory, so this is how I spend my time. I volunteer here a few days a week, and on my off days, I go and volunteer down at the firehouse."
"What you do down there?"
"I fight fires. What you think I do?" she snapped. "Oh," I said, stunned. I mean, she was old, like too old to be hosing down blazing houses, that's for sure. "That's cool."
"That's a lie, baby," she said, grinning and flipping the newspaper back open,
fanning through it until she got to the comics. The rest of my time with her was spent with me standing at the register and her reading funnies out loud
and either bursting with laughter or totally shit-talking about how lame some of them were. Eventually, my body, waist up, started broiling on the inside, and I knew it was time to make my way back to the fourth floor.
Come back and see me, Rashad.
An old lady needs a little company every now and then, Mrs. Fitzgerald said.
I will.
Around 4 o'clock, I had visitors, but it wasn't my family this time. It was my boys.
Housekeeping,
a light voice came from behind the door after a tap.
Housekeeping.
Then came the idiotic snicker of only one person, Carlos.
Don't come in, I yelled.
Oh, come on, Rashad. I know how much you love housekeeping, Carlos said, lowering his voice 10 notches below its normal tone.
He pushed the door open and English, Shannon, and Carlos filed in, backpacks and all.
Oh, man, Shannon said, instantly becoming serious when he saw me lying in the hospital bed, my face swollen, bruised, bandaged.
Dude, English came right behind him, shocked.
It's nothing, I said.
Nothing?
Now even Carlos was serious.
Come on, y'all. I've gotten it from my family already, so just chill. I'm fine, I insisted.
Carlos leaned against the wall. English and Shannon took the chairs. Their eyes, caught between bad and worse, bounced from me to the TV.
The Rashad Show on repeat.
I tried to bait them back in.
Tell me about the party.
Carlos was the first to bite, of course.
Yo, guess who almost got some? Carlos asked, a clownish smile spreading across his face.
Who, English? I replied.
Carlos shot me a mean mug. Really? Really, Shad?
He lowered the lids of his eyes until they were almost closed, then popped them open wide and barked.
Me, man! That dog bark thing totally worked. My game was on a million, man, I swear.
Who was it?
Sweet, sweet Tiffany Watts. Carlos closed his eyes and puckered his lips as if he was remembering some passionate kiss.
I glared at Carlos.
My Tiffany Watts?
Yep, cartoon character-looking Tiffany. Now he wrapped his arms around himself and swayed.
Asshole. My heart stopped. That cop didn't kill me, but the thought of Carlos getting with Tiffany might be the fatal blow.
Shannon couldn't hold it in anymore and burst out laughing. Then Carlos flashed a toothy smile.
Psych, man, you know I wouldn't do you like that. I know her Daffy Duck-looking ass is the love of your life, Carlos teased.
When dealing with a clown like Carlos, the key is to never let him see you flustered. Never let him think you take him seriously. It's the opposite, come to think of it, of how we were trained to deal with police. With your friends, you never put your hands up. I have to admit, though, Los Homos got me with that one.
By the way, she asked about you today, Shannon said.
Word? What'd she say? I asked, eager.
Just that she and a bunch of other people were thinking about coming to visit you, Shannon explained.
No, I waved my hand, as if I was waving off the thought of Tiffany coming.
No one can come. I don't want nobody to see me like this.
You sure? Shannon asked.
Yeah, man, please. Tell everyone I'm fine, but no visitors.
I caught eyes with each of them to make sure they knew I was serious.
I didn't need anybody else standing in front of me, all teary-eyed, or sitting on the edge of the bed feeling awkward. I'd already had enough of that.
When I caught Carlos's eye, he jumped right back into form.
Man, can I finish my story? Damn,
he said, all indignant.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead, I said, trying to rush him along.
So, the girl I got a little closer to was, drum roll, please.
Come on, man, I huffed. You want to know or not?
I don't really care.
Just give me a drum roll, bro, come on.
I shook my head and started patting on my legs, doing my best to ignore the pricking feeling in my abdomen.
Latrice Wilkes.
Carlos blurted this out like a dude squatting behind a couch waiting to yell surprise to an unsuspecting birthday boy.
Latrice Silky Wilkes.
Now, Latrice Wilkes was no slouch. As a matter of fact, she was pretty much one of the coolest, prettiest girls in our class. And Silky really wasn't a nickname. That's just what we called her among each other. And I have no idea why.
For real?
I was honestly surprised. I mean, Latrice was way out of Carlos's league.
Okay, well, then why was it an almost?
Because,
Because then Latrice saw English, Shannon interjected with perfect timing.
Whatever. It's because the cops came and messed my whole groove up, Carlos shot back.
I laughed hard. Well, as hard as I could without feeling like my head was going to explode or my ribs were going to rip through my chest. Once I finally got it under control, I said, well, listen, if it makes you feel any better, the cops messed my groove up, too.
None of them laughed. Not one of them.
You could almost feel the temperature of the room drop, like the way light dims whenever a cloud floats in front of the sun. I was that cloud. So I changed the subject. Anyway, what else is going on at school?
Same old shit.
You ain't missed much except for the fact that everybody's talking about you, Shannon explained.
Yeah, you finally popular, Carlos mocked.
I couldn't figure out if he was trying to bring the mood back to a lighter tone or if he was just trying to make up for getting crushed by Shannon. Or both. This might even land you an actual date with Tiffany.
Please, I don't need no broken nose to get a girl.
The mere mention of it made the bandage itchy. I scratched it super gently.
Take what you can get, bro. It's an easy layup, Carlos replied.
Too bad you didn't have all this layup knowledge when you were trying out for the team, huh?
I owed him a good one for the I almost got with Tiffany joke.
Redemption.
Yeah, whatever.
Me and Carlos went back and forth because it's what we do. But neither one of our hearts was in it. The jokes lacked punch. No zing, just flat.
Like the family circus.
Forget all that, man. When you getting out of here? Shannon asked. He stretched his legs, crossed them at the ankles.
The doctor just left right before y'all got here. He said my nose and ribs are healing fine, but they're still watching me because I got some internal bleeding. He said it hasn't gotten any worse, thank God, and that after a few more days, I should be good to go.
Sweet, Carlos said. Meant it.
Cool, Shannon said.
English didn't say nothing. He just stared at the TV like he was in a trance.
English, you good? I asked.
Yeah, yeah, he said, snapping out of it.
I don't know, man. This is crazy.
You know that's Gutso's brother, right?
Gutso?
Yeah, big giant goony kid on the team. His brother is the asshole who did this to you. Paul Galuzzo. That's why they call Gutso Gutso. It's short for Galuzzo, English explained.
Wait, you telling me the ogre-looking dude on the team, that's his brother? I asked.
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
Has he said anything?
Not that I know of. Coach Carney won't let us talk about it, English explained. Says we gotta focus on the team and our season, and that's it, and to leave all this stuff at the door. Said he'd bench anybody who brought it on the court.
And you can't afford to be benched, dude, especially since scouts are checking for you hard, I said.
Yeah,
but it's just nuts.
Yo, what I want to know is, what the hell happened? Shannon jumped in. Since Carney's made it clear that I ain't allowed to ask Gutso, let me hear your side of the story. I mean, English told us what Barry said, but I want to hear it from you.
That was my cue. I knew English had already heard most of it from his sister, but I still gave the fellas the play-by-play, hoping that somewhere in it, it would make sense. But it didn't. I grabbed a bag of chips, reached into my bag to grab my cell phone. A random lady tripped over me, and the next thing I know, I was getting pressed out by the officer. There really wasn't anything else to the story as far as I was concerned. The cop and the clerk thought I was stealing and wouldn't give me a chance to explain.
Did you resist? Shannon asked.
Why would I resist? Come on, man. You know I was shook. Ain't no way I was resisting, I said. And when he got me on the ground, that's when he really started going in. Like, every time he hit me, I would move. Who wouldn't? It hurt. And then he'd tell me to stop moving, but I couldn't help it.
Shit, Carlos said, his eyes full wide. English was staring at the TV again, his face now becoming a fist, tight and angry. The room was stifling with the weird tension, this strange sadness, when finally Shannon spoke up.
English.
English didn't respond.
English,
Shannon snapped.
What?
He snapped back. And that's when I could tell this whole thing was getting to him. It was stirring him up inside in a way that I had never seen before.
I mean, this was Inglis Jones, the coolest dude on earth.
Inglis braced his hands on either arm of the chair, and for a second, I thought he was going to throw it. But then he drew a deep breath and simply said, "We got practice. We got to go." He looked from Shannon to me, his eyes slightly glassy. He stood up. Shannon stood with him.
"Yo, what we going to do about this?"
Carlos asked, watching Inglis and Shannon grab their bags. He ran his finger along his nose like he always did when he was thinking of something he probably shouldn't have been thinking of.
"I don't know, but I'm telling you, Coach ain't playing,"
Shannon said, flinging his bag up on his shoulder. "Just leave it alone," I said.
"Nah, man, we gotta do something, Shot. I mean, maybe you can't do nothing because you in here, and maybe these two can't do nothing because of punk-ass Carney, but I'm not on the team."
Carlos caught my eye and stopped me from cracking a basketball joke before I could even open my mouth.
"So I can do something. Somebody gotta do something."
"Los, just don't be stupid," Inglis warned, coming over to the bed and giving me five. Carlos didn't respond. Instead, he just asked me if I wanted him to stay. Carlos didn't have anywhere to be. He never had anywhere to be.
"Nah, I'm cool," I said. "I'm sure my parents and my crazy brother will be by here later."
"Word," from Carlos.
"We'll be back tomorrow,"
from Shannon, reaching out for my hand.
Only a nod from Inglis.
And then it was just me, the TV and the shadows, fades, and outlines of my art again. I thought about the fact that Inglis and Shannon wanted to do something but were afraid to break the rules. I understood. I did. But the look on Inglis's face was a look I had never seen. He was struggling with it all. Maybe it was what happened to me that was eating him. Or maybe it was the fact that he felt like he couldn't do anything about it. And then I thought about what kind of ridiculous plan Carlos might cook up. I just didn't want him to put himself in some stupid situation where he got his ass beat too. Even though I hadn't had to put myself in any situation for that to happen. I glanced at the TV. My face. Again.
Wasn't there anything else going on? I mean, there had to be something going on in the Middle East, right? Celebrity drama? Anything besides me.
I wasn't sure what to do about any of it, or if I even wanted anyone else to do anything on my behalf. The looks on my friends and family's faces, it hurt me to see them that way. Especially knowing that it hurt them to see me this way. I didn't deserve this. None of us did. None of us. I grabbed the remote, pointed it at the screen, and hit the power button to click it off. But it didn't go off. I clicked it again. Nothing. I slapped the remote in my palm a few times because that's what you do to, I guess, activate the batteries. Clicked again. Nothing. Now, split screen. Galuzzo's face next to mine. Him in his uniform. Me and mine. But we were not the same. We were not the same.
I didn't deserve this.
Click. Nothing. Click. Nothing. My eyes began to well up, and my throat suddenly felt scorched as if I had swallowed fire.
Click. 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 Nothing. Fuck!
Click.
Please. Please turn off. Please. His face next to mine. I didn't do nothing. I didn't do nothing. His face made my bones hurt. A scrapey feeling in the marrow stuff. Fuck.
Click. Nothing.
Click. Nothing. I couldn't take it anymore, and before I did something stupid like throw the remote across the room, smashing it into hundreds of plastic pieces that I wish were Galuzzo's face, I leaped from the bed in a panic and yanked the cord from the wall, which turns out was also stupid because it felt like giant hands that I couldn't see were ripping me in half.
But the TV was off. My face next to his, gone. Finally.
Tuesday. Quinn. On Tuesday morning, everything changed. for real. Spray painted in wide, loopy neon blue letters like a script of stars so bright they glowed in the day and stretched so large it covered the entire sidewalk at the foot of the front of the stairs was a graffiti tag. A tag so huge every single student, teacher, administrator, staff member, parent, and visitor to Springfield Central had to step over or around and could not miss, "Rashad is absent again today." Everybody was staring at it, taking photos of it, posing with it, and definitely talking about it. As soon as I saw it, I felt a ball of shredded nerves unwind and whip around my stomach. Oh, shit. And my first thought was probably just like everyone else's. Who'd done it? At first, you could tell the teachers were deliberately avoiding discussing it, but it was pretty much all we, the students, talked about between classes or at lunch. I say we, but I was still trying to take coach's advice and ignore all distractions, so when it came up, I tried not to engage, but it was friggin' impossible. At lunch, kids were taking food from the cafeteria and heading out to the front steps, eating and talking while sitting near the giant graffiti tag, but I avoided that and looked for some of the guys on the team in the cafeteria. We'd always sat together at lunch, only in fragments, never the whole team together. But with the impromptu gathering out front, everything had shifted. Only Guzzo, Dwyer, Hales, and Regan sat inside, the four other white guys on the team. Guzzo looked up and saw me in line. He waved me over to their table, and although he'd ignored me all day yesterday, his interest now kind of ticked me off. See, that wasn't Guzzo's style. Usually he'd let others call the shots, but today he was too insistent, beckoning me like he was some kind of mafia boss, and I was supposed to hustle right over to him. And besides, once I had my sad, soupy, sloppy Joe on the tray and looked out over the rest of the cafeteria, I realized it wasn't just the basketball team divided up this way today. Paul had once told me about how the city's demographics had changed over the last 30 years and why that mattered for his job. "It's harder to be a cop here now than it used to be," he'd said. And his facts had been so particular I couldn't help but think of them now as I looked across the deserted tables in the half-empty room. 30 years ago, the city had been 84% white, Paul told me. Now, not counting Hispanics and Latinos who identified as white, Springfield was 37% white. Strange how some of that stuff just sticks to you, especially the shit that suddenly feels so real. Because right now, only about half the high school who had lunch fifth period sat in the cafeteria that day. The white half. I would have stood there like an idiot, feeling those nerves in my stomach start to spin again, if I hadn't felt a push from behind. "Hey," Jill said. "Hey, where are you sitting?" It was probably the first time since I'd been in high school that I'd ever been asked that question. I'm not a total fucknut. I know for some people, especially at the beginning of high school, where to sit and who you'll sit with is a big deal. Not everyone feels like they automatically belong. Not everyone feels like wherever they go, they'll be welcome. But I did. I'd always just walked into the cafeteria and sat wherever the hell I wanted. In fact, I did that pretty much anywhere I went, unless the seats were already assigned. I paused. "Not sure." "Yeah, but you know what's weird? I want to go sit outside." "Me too," I said, only realizing when she had said it, that that's what I really did want to do. But would that be weird? I just said it was weird, but I don't think anyone out there would mind. Huh. I hadn't thought of it like that. I'd been thinking of the guys inside. "No," I said, nodding to Guzzo's table. "Those dudes." Guzzo probably realized what we were talking about because he got up and walked over to us. "You two gonna stand there all day? Come, sit down." And once he had come over, it felt impossible not to follow him, so we did. Dwyer, Hales, and Regan got lost in a conversation about their fantasy basketball league teams while Guzzo pressed us. "Seriously," he said, "you two are spending a lot of time together." Jill laughed. "You guys are all family to me." "Quinn's not," Guzzo said, looking at me, but in an odd way. "Not really. Or is he?" "I'm right here, man. No need to be all cold about it." "I'm not the one who ran away from the barbecue." "Jesus. Seriously? You're crying about that?" He opened his mouth to say something more, but Jill interrupted him. Guys, you've been at it since Friday. I've seen it. This shut us both up. I bit into my hash brown, but it was so greasy I just ended up shoving the whole thing in my mouth. While I chewed, Guzzo gave me that look again. Quinn's the one acting weird. Come on, Jill said. It's not only him. You are too, but why not? I would be too if I had been there and seen Paul wailing on Rashad. What the fuck? Guzzo threw his plastic fork down on his tray. Shut up about that. Hales glanced over skeptically, and Guzzo leaned in close to us. Did you tell anyone else? He asked her. That you were there? She said. No? Is it a secret? Of course, Guzzo said, his hand clenched into a fist. You told her, he said to me. Are you fucking demented? Nobody should know about this, not even my brother. What? Man, we aren't in any trouble. We didn't do anything. You really are stupid, Guzzo said, picking his fork back up and pointing it at me. Red bits of sloppy Joe dripped from the tines. Don't tell anyone else we were there. The Force, they're worried for my brother. They've given him some time so he can stay off the streets. There's probably going to be a lawsuit, because there's always a lawsuit these days. Look, whatever. How the hell is he supposed to do what he needs to do if he gets sued for just doing his job? Listen to you, Jill exclaimed. Leaning in now, too, agitated. You sound like our mothers. But tell that to Rashad's family. Rashad's absent today, again. I mean, I know that guy, too. Guzzo looked disgusted. You don't know him, he said, waving her off. You just like thinking you know him because now he's a celebrity victim, or whatever. That's bullshit. He gestured to the doors behind us. You need to get outside before next period? Was that where you were headed, before I called you over? I glanced at Jill. Dude, I said to Guzzo, come on. It doesn't have to be like that.
It already is like that, asshole, Guzzo said.
He pushed his chair back and stood up.
You know, Paul was just trying to help someone inside the store. That's what he says. And then there's the whole stopping people from stealing thing.
He was breathing heavy, fighting to find words.
And, by the way, he finally said, pointing at me, Paul's staying with us, you know. If you're curious, remember him? My brother? The dude who fucking raised you? Feel free to drop by. I mean, you are like family, isn't he, Jill?
For once in her life, Jill didn't shoot back the last word. Then Guzzo stalked off without looking back at either of us. I was about to get up, too, because I was sick of it all. I hadn't started it. Why the hell did I have to be in the middle of it? But as I pushed my own chair back, Dwyer grabbed my arm. Listen, man, he said. You've got to fix this. You've got to get the team straight. We've got scouts coming, man. This is too big. This is our life, man. Our futures. Don't be a dick about it. Like Coach said, leave it at the door, all of it, you know? What he said stuck with me for the rest of the day. Yeah, I was thinking about the damn scouts, too. Of course I was. The kind of doors a scout's praise might open, the kinds of scholarships a kid like me needed when Ma was working night shifts over at U-Line. I knew it was my future, and Dwyer's, and everyone else's too. How could I not? It had been on my mind in one way or another since I'd started working out with Paul, back when he was taller than me, not just bigger, flicking his wrists and teaching me how to sneak a crossover right in front of my opponent. Those hands. There was so much history, slapping hands and saying yes to Paul. As what Dwyer had said to me replayed again and again in my head, it began to say something else, too. Like, maybe I was hearing what Dwyer was saying under his breath, between his words. He almost sounded scared, or not scared, but nervous. It wasn't Dwyer, it was fear. It seemed to follow me like my shadow these days, but I recognized now how it was trailing everyone else, too. At practice, Coach had us running like crazy. Hales got so winded he puked in the trash can by the door to the hallway. Boot and rally! Regan yelled to him. He wanted to laugh, but he was too out of breath. The rest of us crouched with our hands on our knees or folded on our heads, trying to avoid cramps. And Coach paced in between us like he was a doctor walking through the asthma ward. Game ready, he lectured. The team that makes its free throws when everyone is tired and strung out is the team that wins its games. Then he broke us into groups at the six baskets around the gym and told us to keep score. 10 free throws each, switching shooters every 2 shots. The score mattered. He didn't say it, but this was part of the evaluation to see who would be a starter. Who could get points on the board at the beginning of the game and at the end of the game when his legs were jelly and his lungs afire collapsing? A scout might be the key to your future, but you had to be on the court in a pressure situation, sticking it to the other team in order for the scout to even see you. Then you had to make the shot. I missed my first shot, but it was the only one I missed. There were plenty of 7 out of 10, some lower. Only English scored a perfect 10. We spent another hour practicing some plays, putting them into action in little scrimmages, and then coach sent us to the weight room in pairs. We didn't have to keep score here, not for his sake, at least. Of course, we kept score among ourselves. Nobody could press or lift or squat nearly as much as Guzzo and Toombs and Martinez, so they always had their own competition, and the rest of us had ours. I paired up with English, and we started on the leg machines while the big guys hit the bench. He and I didn't say much at first, but as we moved around the room to different machines, we got into what was really on both our minds. "Hey, man," I asked, "you know who wrote that graffiti?" "Why are you asking me?" he said. "He's your friend, man. He has a lot of friends." "Come on, man, I'm just curious, I'm just asking." "Nah, it can't be just asking, it never is." "Fine." I put another 5 pounds on either side of the bar for him, and then kept my voice low as I continued. "Guzzo's pissed. He thinks someone did it to make a statement." English cocked half a grin as he lay down beneath the bar and began his set. "Of course. That's the point." "No, but like, it's saying that Rashad is innocent, so that makes his brother guilty." English put his bar back up on the rack and sat up. He looked at me like I was nuts. "Man, Rashad didn't do shit." "Yeah, but what if Paul was just doing his job? Then no one's guilty." But even as I said it, I felt like I was Guzzo suddenly. Or someone in the family, his family, and I wished I wasn't. Never mind. Let's just forget it. "Forget it! Forget my friend is in the hospital." English stared at me, pissed. "Since when is beating the shit out of somebody who hasn't done a damn thing just doing your job? Man, there's no way I'm gonna pretend it didn't happen." He leaned back, looked at the ceiling, and pressed the weight back up. "I can't." He brought the weight down and then up again. "I won't." He lifted the bar again quickly, but on the 8th rep, he struggled. "Look," I said, reaching out, ready to help him with the next rep. "I just wish this wasn't happening. I mean, for everyone's sake." He fought to get the 9th rep more than halfway up. "You need a hand?" I said, putting my fingers beneath the bar, helping him lift it slightly. "Fuck no," he spat. I pulled my fingers back but kept them close. He pushed the bar up slowly, then lowered it and began the last rep. He grunted and got the last one up and onto the rack. "Maybe he got out of hand," I just had to say. "Maybe he was on drugs." "On drugs? What are you, 75? Since when have you ever gotten off your ass, let alone thrown a punch, when you were stoned, man?" "Meth? Only white people do that shit." "Fuck you, man. No, fuck you, Quinn." He stood and pointed at me. "Why does it automatically gotta be Rashad's fault? Why do people think he was on drugs? That dude doesn't do drugs. He's ROTC, man. His dad would kick his ass. You do drugs, asshole." "Just a puff here and there, man. Come on, I don't do drugs. I've seen you smoking a blunt. Metcalf sold you that shit. Metcalf, a white dude, by the way. Man, that shit could have been laced with crack or fucking Drano. You don't know what you're talking about." "Look, man, I'm not trying to say anything bad about Rashad. I'm just saying that spray painting 'Rashad is absent again today' on the concrete in front of the school is like, I don't know, extreme. He's not dead. But he could be. You have no idea. You have no idea, Quinn. The point is, he could be. Then what? Is that what it would take to look at this thing differently? You need him to be dead? Shame on you, man. I had no idea you were such a dick. You want to forget all this? Maybe you can, but I won't." He stood and caught his breath. "What do you know anyway?" White boy like you can just walk away whenever you want. Everyone just sees you as Mr. All-American Boy, and you can just keep on walking, thinking about other things. Just keep on living, like this shit don't even exist. He waved his hand in my face and blew a breath out the side of his mouth. Man, I'm done with you. Then he sauntered off slowly, making sure I knew he was dismissing me, leaving me looking like the idiot I was. When Coach called us back out to the court, I was now not just physically wiped, but mentally wiped too. I was getting a drink of water at the fountain, and Guzzo came up behind me. He jabbed me in the back, and I coughed up the water. He laughed.
Thanks, he said, grinning. I mean it. I heard all that with English. Thanks for having Paul's back.
An unexpected wave of anger surged through me. That hadn't been my intention at all. I'd seen what Paul had done. I didn't think it was right. But I hadn't thought the spray paint was right either.
Maybe somebody should spray paint something else tomorrow, Guzzo said. What do you think it should say?
Don't, I said.
What?
Don't be an asshole.
Guzzo slapped the wall with his open palm. I don't fucking get you, man. 1 minute you're in there defending my brother, and the next you're basically telling me to fuck off. You're demented.
He stomped off to join the huddle at half court. Thank God Coach didn't try to get us all together in a rallying cry, because I sure as hell wasn't up for it. And neither was anyone else, probably. Instead, he broke us into two teams of five and put the others on the bench, ready to sub in. I was on the same team as English, and before we began, I pulled him aside. Look, I said, I'm sorry, man. I sounded like an idiot. He didn't say anything back. No, seriously, I'm sorry. I don't want to be a dick. I'm just trying to figure this all out. Rashad's your friend, but I get what else you're saying too, so I'm sorry. Man, you have no idea how many times you sounded like a dick. You think it was just today? Look, he said, passing me the ball hard. Just don't miss when I give you the ball. But I did. When we got into the scrimmage, I popped free and missed the first open shot. I got another chance on a fast break, and I could have passed, but I forced a difficult shot because I'd missed the last one. I missed that one too. Coach called me over. Where's your head? Up my ass, I blurted.
What?
He grabbed my arm.
What did you say?
My head, I said, it's up my ass. I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Maybe a couple of suicides will wipe the shit off your face. Do them. Two. Along the sideline. Now. Go.
I didn't have to look at Guzzo to know he was smiling all smug, watching me out of the corner of his eye while he continued playing. I think English was maybe smiling too. And for the first time since I could remember, as I sprinted up and down the court, I didn't have my father's voice in my head. I heard my own. I wasn't telling myself to push or to go faster. Instead, I thought about the guy who just said all those things to English. The guy who hadn't meant to sound hurtful. The guy who was just trying to walk down the middle and not disturb anybody, basically give some meaning to what I'd seen in the street outside Jerry's. And here's what I realized I was saying beneath it all. I didn't want my life to change from the way it was before I'd seen that. When I finished the suicides, I had to hold my hand against the wall to catch my breath. English was freaking right. The problem was that my life didn't have to change. If I wanted to, I could just keep my head down and focus on the team like Coach wanted, and that could be that. Isn't that what I wanted? Then why did it feel so shitty? I had to squat down and touch the floor, feeling suddenly nauseous. Nauseous at the idea that I could just walk away from everything that was happening to Rashad, everything that was happening to Paul, everything that was happening to everyone at school, everything that was happening to me, too. I could just walk away from it all like a ghost. What kind of person did that make me, if I did? Those were Ma's words, and when I got home, I found myself, for the first time in a long time, also admitting that I wished she was home and not working. Of course, that made me feel like a goddamn kid, so I made myself feel like I was worth something by helping Willie with his homework. He was glad for it, but probably not as much as I was that he needed me, and I could actually help him figure out his fractions. Later, though, my mind drifted back to Rashad, and I totally blew dinner. It should have been simple. I'd made mac and cheese with tuna, peas, and hot sauce more times than I could count, but I overcooked the pasta and there was way too much hot sauce. Willie fanned his mouth after the first bite.
"Ha ha!" he said. "Are you trying to kill me?"
I improvised by shredding some extra cheddar cheese into our bowls, and guiltily, I felt glad that he had his headphones on, though Ma would have killed him for that stunt at the dinner table, because my thoughts would not let up. Now I was thinking about how, if I wanted to, I could walk away and not think about Rashad in a way that English or Shannon or Toombs or any of the guys at school who were not white could not. Even if they didn't know Rashad, even if for some reason they hated Rashad, they couldn't just ignore what happened to him. They couldn't walk away. They were probably afraid too. Afraid of people like Paul. Afraid of cops in general. Hell, they were probably afraid of people like me. I didn't blame them. I'd be afraid too, even if I was a freaking house like Toombs. But I didn't have to be, because my shield was that I was white. It didn't matter that I knew Paul. I could be all the way across the country in California, and I'd still be white. Cops and everyone else would still see me as just a regular kid, an all-American boy. Regular. All-American. White. Fuck. But then, after dinner, as I was helping Willie with the last of his math homework, I realized something worse. It wasn't only that I could walk away. I already had walked away. Well, I was sick of it. I was sick of being a dick. Not watching the damn video was walking away too, and I needed to watch it. I borrowed Willie's headphones, plugged them into my phone, loaded up YouTube, and I watched it right there at the kitchen table. It was the shaky video taken from across the street at Jerry's, and I was immediately back at Friday night, watching it happen all over again. There were two other videos too. I watched Rashad's body twisting on the concrete sidewalk. The video was taken from too far away. I couldn't hear what he was saying. I couldn't hear Paul. I heard the noise of the street just as I'd heard it that night, and I felt a zip line of fear rip right into the pit of my stomach. On Friday, I'd been down the street watching, but there, at the Formica table, I had a front row seat. Close to Rashad and Paul, I could almost see myself hovering just beyond the frame of the shot. I texted Jill and told her how bizarre it was to see it. Tuesday, 9:43 p.m., from Jill. Finally. Now everybody's seen it. We went back and forth a few times, and then I just got fed up. Tuesday, 9:55 p.m., to Jill. Hey, can you talk? Tuesday, 9:56 p.m., from Jill. What? Tuesday, 9:56 p.m., to Jill. No, I mean it, on the phone. Talk? Tuesday, 9:57 p.m., from Jill. Whatever. Tuesday, 9:57 p.m., to Jill. Like, I need to talk. She buzzed a second later, and I got up, slid the headphones across the table to Willie, and left the kitchen. We said our hellos and all that as I walked into the living room. I feel so gross, I said. I keep telling myself it isn't my problem, but it is. It is my problem. I just don't know what to do. Yeah. But it isn't only your problem, it's everyone's problem. But I still don't know what to do, like, tell the police? She paused and I heard her breathe. Maybe? Jesus. Telling the police meant telling Paul's friends. Meant Paul's friends telling him what I was doing. But everyone's seen it, Quinn. It's all our problem, but what is that problem? Then it was my turn to be quiet, and I shuffled over to the couch and sat down. What is it? Her voice rose. Excessive violence? I don't know. Unnecessary beating? Shit. Police brutality? Yeah. And, you know, the way it's all working out, it's more. Like, who was sitting where at lunch? I looked at the carpet between my feet. Yeah. And whose lockers they looked in first for spray paint cans. Yeah, shit, really? That happened? That's what I saw. Three black students, boys, in a row, then Martinez, they skipped me. Fuck. I let the air in my cheeks fill and then slowly blow out. So, yeah, like, all that. like Paul's white and Rashad's black. I just sat there staring at the door to the kitchen like a dumbass zombie trying to find some words. Paul says he did what he did because he was protecting some white lady in the store, Jill added. What? Yeah, that's what my mom says, but, really? Seriously. You think it would have been the same if the lady wasn't white or if Rashad wasn't black? Seriously. Seriously what? Why is it taking me 5 minutes to say the word racism? Maybe you're racist? Don't joke, this is serious. I'm not racist. She hesitated, and I sat there stinking in my own sweat, needing her to say something. Eventually she did. Not like KKK racist, she said. I don't think most people think they're racist. But every time something like this happens, you could, like you said, say not my problem. You could say it's a one-time thing. Every time it happened. I wanted to say something, but it was like my head just pounded and every word that came to mind just shook and fell back into my throat. I think it's all racism, Jill said for me. And if I don't do something, I finally mustered, if I just stay silent, it's just like saying it's not my problem. Mr. Fisher spent our whole history class talking about it. If anybody wanted to talk about it more after school, he would. Me and Tiffany talked about it all day, so we went. There were a bunch of us there, and Fisher's helping us figure out what to do. I wish I could have gone, but I had basketball, but I have to do something. Let's see what other people are doing tomorrow. We said our goodbyes, and I sat there on the couch, staring into the kitchen, looking at Willie. His head bent down so close to the paper he was scribbling his answers on, the red headphones like beacons on either side of his head. It was like he was buried deep within his own little world. I felt like I'd been doing the same damn thing the last couple days, trying to stare so hard at my own 2 feet so I wouldn't have to look up and see what was really going on. And while I'd been doing that, I'd been walking in the wrong direction. I didn't want to walk away anymore.
Rashad. As the story of 16-year-old West Springfield native Rashad Butler develops, the city seems to be split in terms of which side of the argument they fall on in this case. Was it about race, the abuse of power, or was it just another case of a teenage criminal caught red-handed? For those who are just joining us, we've been covering this story for a few days now. Last Friday, Butler was accused of shoplifting, public nuisance, and resisting arrest. The officer involved, Paul Galuzzo, is shown here forcibly removing Butler from Jerry's Corner Mart. Butler seems to be cooperating with the officer, but as you can see, he is taken to the ground. Warning, the rest of the scene is a bit graphic. We were able to catch up with Claudia James, the person who actually shot this footage from her phone.
It was just like y'all saw it. That boy was being manhandled, and he kept saying that he didn't do nothing. He kept trying to explain, but the officer was just yelling, "Shut up, shut up," and then slammed him. Then once he had him on the ground, he started, like, punching and kneeing him in the back. He shoved his forearm on the back of the boy's neck. It was crazy.
But had he been handcuffed?
Once he was on the ground, he was. I mean, how could he have been resisting?
But not everyone shares Miss James's view. Some people feel that whatever it takes to clean up the community, so be it. Like Roger Stuckey. We don't know what happened in that store, so I'm not going to sit here and just say this kid is innocent. He might not be. I'm a cab driver and I work nights, and the truth is, if that kid was trying to hell me down and it was dark outside, I would keep on going.
And why is that? Because of the way he looks?
I mean, listen, I've been robbed before, right around here. And I don't ever want to be robbed again. And he looks like the guy who robbed me. He was dressed just like him. These kids are crazy these days. And whatever it's going to take to make the people who live around here feel safe, I'm all for it. When I woke up, I followed the same routine as the day before. Well, not exactly the same. First, I plugged the TV back in. Then I tried to turn it on, but the remote was still on the fritz. Sometimes when the batteries are getting weak and smacking it against your palm doesn't work, you have to slide the back off and run your thumb over the batteries to turn them. and that makes them work. Sometimes. This time. The TV came on, and I watched for a minute. Everyone had opinions. The lady who caught the incident on tape seemed to side with me and thought the cop was wrong, but not everybody felt that way. There was a cabbie who straight up said he wouldn't pick me up if he saw me at night. That really pissed me off. I mean, I had heard Spoonie talk about that for years. I never took cabs. The bus was cheaper. But he was always going on and on about how he could never catch a cab because of the way